RSV Academy. Talking about RSV within Falsi. A deep dive into RSV in adults.
Welcome to RSV Academy podcast, where we explore the latest breakthroughs and developments in the world of RSV science. I am Professor Federico Martinon Torres, your host today in this scientific education activity brought to you by the University of Santiago de Compostela and the Healthcare Research Institute of Santiago in Spain. Today, we are privileged to have with us Professor Anne Falsi, a distinguished researcher and a leading authority in the field of respiratory syncytial virus, and by the way, also a member of the scientific committee of the RSV Academy itself. So welcome, Anne. I hope you are great.
Thank you, Federico. It's a pleasure to be with you this morning, or this afternoon.
Thank you. Anne Falsi is professor of medicine at the University of Rochester, and she's a renowned researcher with significant contributions to the field of infectious disease, and also very specifically on the field of RSV. Professor Falsi's work has significantly contributed to our understanding of RSV, particularly in the context of other adults. Her research has shed light on the prevalence of RSV in older adults and its impact on their health. But she has been also instrumental in the development of potential vaccines for RSV. So let's get started, Anne. And although I can guess your answer, my very first question would be, do RSV matter in the adults, or is just an infant or a pediatric problem?
So I'm sure you anticipate my response. Yes, it is a significant cause of illness and then, you know, serious disease, hospitalizations and deaths in older adults and then adults with certain chronic medical conditions.
And how does it compare with the pediatric RSV? I mean, sometimes comparisons are unfair, and it's obvious that the incidence of RSV infection or the RSV severe infection are higher in the infant age, no? But how does it compare the burden of disease in the adult population to the pediatric population?
So the annual incidence in infants less than a year old is much higher. So those little babies are not immune to RSV, and generally we all get an RSV infection in the first few years of life. And so, you know, at least in the United States, the birth cohort is about 4 million people. And then once you become immune, the actual rate of infection decreases, even in older children, young adults, and also in older adults, so that the rate of infection each year drops from maybe 50% to 5%. But there's a lot more older adults. So the burden of disease is actually quite large, because although maybe only 5% of the older population gets infected, the sequelae can be quite severe.
Mm-hmm. And when you compare, or you try to frame the importance of RSV as compared to other respiratory pathogens in the adult population, how does it look like? I mean, when you compare RSV, for example, with flu and other usual pathogens in the elderly population.
Yeah, we always used to use influenza A as our yardstick, because everybody understands that flu is bad. It's particularly bad in older adults. So whenever we did our studies, we would always not only diagnose RSV, we would diagnose flu, so we get a sense of where we're standing. And I would say that RSV is second to flu. In some years, when a certain kind of flu is circulating, it can be equivalent or even greater. So, you know, as you know, influenza has multiple subtypes. And so influenza A, H3N2, is particularly hard on older people, whereas influenza B and influenza H1N1 may be a little less severe. So in years when those strains dominate, you know, RSV is kind of rivals flu, whereas when it's H3N2, flu A really kind of dominates the scene. And then I would say that when we've studied multiple viruses, it usually stacks up as flu A is the worst, RSV is kind of second, and then human metapneumovirus kind of comes in third. And then there's a lot of other seasonal respiratory viruses in the mix.
Okay, I think you gave us a very clear picture. And I have another question of you, which is, of course, based on one of your recent papers. So I know the answer, but I would like to, the audience to know it. I mean, for us as pediatricians, RSV is also an important nosocomial agent, no? And we see it often, and we know that during the season, we see a lot of nosocomial cases of RSV infection. But how is it in the adult population? Does it matter as a nosocomial agent, or is not?
Well, I think the real answer is we don't know, because we internists are not so used to thinking about and testing for RSV. And influenza is understood. I think in certain populations, such as bone marrow transplant patients, they are very well aware of how serious these nosocomial viral infections can be. But on the general medical wards, they don't tend to think about RSV. They think about flu, and now they think about COVID, but they're not thinking about, nor are they testing for RSV. So there may be significantly more than we know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think there are some studies. There was a study in Spain, and I think it was replicated in many countries now with the arrival of COVID and increase on testing, no, and the use of multi-test or multi-array tests. RSV seemed like an emergent disease, no, in the adult population in some manner, no, because it was started to be detected, no, more oftenly than usual, and I think it was the case in many areas. In my own hospital, no, RSV looked like an additional burden of COVID itself, no, like a re-emergent agent.
Yeah, you bring up an absolute great point. You know, I had, when we went to molecular testing and multiplex testing, I had colleagues coming to me going, "What is going on with RSV in older people?" And I'm like, "Nothing's going on. It's always been there. You just weren't testing for it." So, you know, last year I think was a little unique. There was at least in the U.S., there was an early peak. It was generally quite intense. So the seasonality of RSV, I think, is still a little bit off, readjusting to the, I guess we call it post-pandemic, but, you know, endemic SARS.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and talking about that, I have a few difficult questions in that regard, precisely about the epidemiology of RSV itself. Is it different in some manner from the epidemiology of RSV in the pediatric patients? I mean, who infects whom? Or is there any sequence in that? You know what I mean? It's something that we assume, no, that the children or the infants do infect the adult population. But is that the case? Do we have proof for that? Where does actually the season start?
So I don't think we have concrete proof, but there is some evidence. There was some research done by Karen Hall at the University of Rochester, who did family studies. And then some of the studies that have been done out in Michigan with the family, Tecumseh family studies, that the introduction of RSV into the household seems to be school-age kids. And there it goes to the vulnerable little baby and then also to the older adults. People who have looked at sort of the waves and the activity of RSV generally find there's somewhat of a lag between the peak in RSV in children and older adults, roughly around 1 to 2 weeks, suggesting, you know, if the kids get it, it gets prevalent, they infect grandma and grandpa.
Mm-hmm. But where do you think RSV hides in between seasons? No, because it doesn't have a human reservoir. I mean, it doesn't have anything different to a human reservoir. No, and we see this clear seasonality, at least before the pandemic, of course. And where does RSV hide?
Yeah, great question. Probably in people with immune issues. So if you actually do detailed viral testing the entire year, you will occasionally pick up RSV in the summer. It's just very uncommon. And we also know that people who have immunosuppression never really clear things. And so it's probably really at some very low level in the summer months. And then, you know, why exactly does it explode in the winter? We all have our own theories. It gets cold, people come together, the humidity is different. Those are philosophical questions and scientific questions. Mm-hmm. I don't have all the answers to, but I suspect it's lurking in the human population at a low level.
Yeah, no, I tend to agree, but as you may be realizing, I'm trying to blame the adults, not the children. So I think that indeed the children are the fuel once the season starts. No, but where does it hide is probably, as you say, the immunodepressed population and maybe some of your high-risk patients, COPD patients that may have at a lower level, no, the virus there in some cases. And in some place, it has to be hidden. No, so clearly, I prefer to blame the adults and not the children, at least for this.
I can't say that's true.
Yeah. And another question related to, I mean, you also mentioned it and you published recently, no, the change in the epidemiology itself, no, during the pandemic. What is your guess for the upcoming season? Where do you expect that we will be back to normal seasonality of RSV, or what's your guess?
My guess would be we'll be approaching normal, but quite normal. When it came roaring back in 2021 in children, it was, at least in the U.S., I'm not sure about Europe, a very weird summer summer epidemic, so very out of season. Last year, it was early, but at least it was in the fall. And this year, I expect it to start moving into its usual space. In adults, it was fascinating to watch this unfold in that when there was the big wave in children, we did not see the usual commensurate wave in older adults, because older adults were still being very cautious and wearing masks and avoiding crowds and probably avoiding their runny-nosed grandchildren. last year, again, human nature being what it is, it loosened up. But we still see people wearing masks that we never did before. And so I think it's a wise thing for a frail older adult or somebody with very bad emphysema. When these viruses start to circulate, they should be wearing a mask. It may not be COVID, but it could be flu or RSV. And I think we know some of those measures were successful.
Yeah, I fully agree. And there are also the several epidemiological studies, no, showing the reduction on chronic respiratory patients, no, the reduction on acute exacerbations, no, based on these non-specific measures against COVID, no, and probably in a individual oriented or a case by case indication may be helpful for that protection. I think it's a good take home message for anyone that is listening to us and may have some chronic condition, no?
Right, right. I think we're starting to refer to it as strategic masking. Not are the mask mandates, but in certain populations at certain times of the year, it makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm. I'm talking precisely about risk in high-risk groups. Who is the target of RSV when we talk about adults? Is any adult at the same risk? Which are the main risk groups? It's an age-dependent risk.
Yeah, so age is clearly a risk factor. It rises pretty steadily and increases over age 65. But even in the over 65-year-old group, there's an increase with each decade of life. So really over 75, there's some nice studies out of the UK that 70 to 75 really seems to be where hospitalization rates increase. But I always like to say age is just a number, and at least in some of the U.S. studies, a large portion of people are age 50 to 64, and those are not healthy people, though. Those are people with heart failure is a big risk factor, COPD is another big risk factor, asthma somewhat, not quite as bad as COPD, but really any underlying lung disease. And then we're clearly being immunocompromised is a risk factor. But then when we think of the non-immunocompromised risk factors, diabetes, chronic kidney disease, neuromuscular disease, those have not been as well studied, but we think that those are probably risk factors. And then in the older population, frailty. So there are a number of frailty scores, which is a combination of underlying diseases and functional ability. And if you put all those together, it gives you a frailty score. So the more frail you are, the more less reserve you have, and the more likely you are to have, you know, a serious illness.
Yeah, I really agree with you, no? And probably we need more studies on a specific subpopulation. So something like that happened, I don't know, with pneumococcal disease, where at the beginning we had very strict or specific risk groups, no? And then we were able to learn, no? How the combination of sometimes different risk factors that are linked to age itself, no? It's like the saying, no? We say here in Spain, if after 50 you don't have any pain or any problem, then it is that you are dead, no? So it's with age you start to accumulate risk factors and morbidities, even if they are not major, but the sum may convert you into a risk space, no? And I think that there are still gaps, no, in the RSV field in this regard. To go beyond the COPD, cardiac failure, that are well-defined risk factors, but probably, as you already anticipated, other more classical risk factors are other that may not be anticipated could be of importance here. Yeah. And I have another question going to the clinical side. What can we expect from the clinical perspective on an RSV infection in the adult population? Is there any specific sign, or is just a flu-like illness? Or can you tell us a little bit on that from the clinical perspective?
Sure. I like to tell people it's a very snotty, phlegmy, wheezy infection. A lot of secretions. It's not the same for everybody. And so, unfortunately, there's a great deal of overlap in the signs and symptoms with all the other respiratory viruses, including influenza. But there are some differences. So if you do big studies and you just compare signs and symptoms, influenza is more often febrile and more often associated with systemic signs and symptoms such as myalgias and arthralgias, whereas RSV is more commonly associated with rhinorrhea, sputum production, and wheezing and shortness of breath. When you look at populations who are admitted to the hospital, the RSV patients tend to be have more underlying diseases, particularly heart and lung disease, than the flu patients. My theory is that flu is a little more dramatic in onset. You get a high fever, you feel terrible. Mm-hmm. You know, you're 75 years old, so you go right to the hospital. They actually seem to do better. They go home quicker than the RSV patients who, there's now some accumulating evidence that they linger longer, have longer hospital stays, and have a slower recovery.
Mm-hmm. And linked to that, what can we expect, I mean, beyond the acute phase, no, and the need of hospitalization, what can RSV do in the patient? I mean, for example, of course, on the one hand is the hospitalization, the mortality that the disease can actually have, no, and that can be comparable to that of flu, no, in this age group. And you published I think it's a hallmark study, no? Your New England Journal of Medicine paper on RSV in the elderly was the first, not really pointing out the difference that RSV was at least as important as flu in terms of the case fatality, among other findings in your paper. But what about the short mid-term morbidity? I mean, for example, in the pediatric patients, we know that once you survive the acute phase, you can develop wheezing, you can develop, there are epidemiological links with asthma. There are some complications that are well, let's say, defined. But in the other population, what can you expect, I mean, beyond the acute phase?
So beyond the acute phase, just immediately is a slow recovery, that the return to full function seems to be slow. The average length of illness is about 17 days, so about 3 weeks, so it's not a quick illness. It can produce reactive airway symptoms, even in people without underlying COPD and asthma. That was actually studied in adults in like pediatric house staff many years ago, where they did PFTs, and they did have obstructive abnormalities that persisted for quite a while. So it's not been studied in detail, the underlying lung issues that might persist, but in an older person, function is paramount. You just got to keep moving, you got to keep being able to take care of yourself, because sometimes a complication worse than death is loss of independence and ending up in a nursing home. So there have been studies that if you were hospitalized with RSV, there can be persistent functional loss. It would be hard to say that it's specific to the RSV. I think, we all know that hospitalization is terrible for older people. So I think the most important thing is to try to abrogate the severity of the illness if you get it, and keep people out of the hospital as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. And I have another question for you. You have also worked on the, let's say, on the pathogenesis, on the immunological part of the disease, no? And we are talking about an infection that you can have any time in your life and several times in your life, no? And clearly affects the infants, and then it comes back, let's say, or attack us with a clinical significant result, no? Later in the adulthood. But what's the difference? I mean, what are the immunological differences? So what can explain the infection in the adult as compared to the infant?
Well, that's a great question, and we don't have a great answer. We actually had a four-year grant to try to tease out some of this. There were observational studies that showed that low serum neutralizing antibody and low nasal antibody was associated with an increased risk of acquisition of infection and then severity of infection. But those were observational studies, and you never know if you're not measuring something else that's actually driving the importance. We also found that older people are not, in general, immunodeficient in antibody. That while low antibody is a risk factor, if you do populations of older adults and compare to the young adults, their baseline antibody levels are pretty much the same. So it would not explain specifically why older people get so ill. Clearly, there's an effect of underlying diseases. And, as you get older, as you pointed out, start accumulating a bunch of underlying conditions. So that's hard to tease out. But also, as we get older, there is clearly immunosenescence, which tends to affect the cellular immune arm more than the humoral immune antibody. And so those studies are just very hard to do because they require a significant volume of blood. And if you're going to do it prospectively, you'd be drawing a lot of blood, which is labor intensive. And the infection rates, although the burden is high, the infection rates are kind of low. So we were not able to define a specific cellular immune defect, although everybody suspects that there is some that predisposes you to not being able to efficiently clear the virus.
Mm-hmm. And we have been already commenting on the lack of awareness in some manner on RSV in clinical practice. And so which would be your practical recommendation when we should seek for RSV infection in an adult patient?
Well, I think one of the problems is, at least in the U.S., they don't want you to test for things which cost money if it's not going to change your management. And so we do not have a specific antiviral for RSV. And in the hospital, generally, at least the adult infection control practices are not airborne or airborne isolation. So testing is actually somewhat discouraged. And so until you actually test widely, I don't think that the providers, I think, can read the papers and say, oh, yeah, that's a disease, but it doesn't hit home to their heart. They don't have their own dear patient that they have taken care of for 30 years who ended up in the hospital and died of RSV because they might have. They just didn't diagnose it. So I would like to see a lot more testing. How we actually affect that is just a little bit of a challenge at the present time.
Mm-hmm. Well, what you say, it sounds familiar for me too, and is not only in the States, no, that if you cannot really impact the patient care, then you are discouraged not to do that. But I also agree that if we don't really do the testing, we don't really know which are the different phenotypes. We don't evolve not only in the awareness, no, but I think it's also a quality thing, no, to know what is happening actually to your patient and to explain exactly what is occurring to him or her, no, irrespective of what can you specifically do. And sometimes by knowing you can avoid unnecessary treatments, antibiotics, etc. No? So I think that I agree that we don't have specific antivirals, but we need to convince the authorities and the hospital managers that putting the label of RSV is important.
No? Yeah, it cuts down on extra testing. You know what the person has. You quite rightly point out that, you know, we can, in some cases, decrease unnecessary antibiotic use. Doctors like to know what their patients have. Patients like to know what they have. And, you know, maybe the answer is the PCR and lab testing, the cost really needs to come down. So it's not so much of a barrier.
Mm-hmm. Well, but I don't want to be very enthusiastic, but I am very happy because maybe RSV is not a problem anymore. Now we have vaccines available, no, for the other population. So I think we need to talk about that, no? And you have been also in first line working with different vaccine candidates, some of them already licensed, no? And I think that at least two are now, at least by the major regulatory agencies, have been already approved for the use in the adult population. So what's your first headline in this regard? I suppose you are happy, and also you have been part of the research. And I also feel envy, no? Because you arrive earlier for the adults than for the infants. But what's your headline about RSV vaccines for the adult population?
So I was over the moon when I first saw Janssen was the first company to come in and have positive results. And then we have now Pfizer, GSK, and Moderna. So the big manufacturers came in. They're all highly effective, you know, over 80% effective to prevent lower respiratory tract illness. And so these are great results. So it's immensely satisfying to have started asking the question, is this enough of a disease to worth to begin programs for, to having something you can actually offer people? We still have some significant hurdles because in order for vaccines to have an impact, they have to be used.
And yeah, nice sense. Nice.
There's several, at least in the U.S., again, some barriers there. So the FDA approves it. They're approved vaccines for anybody over 60. But then there are recommending bodies that, depending on the recommendations, they are covered under insurance. And I was not thrilled with the recommendation, which was shared decision making. So they didn't recommend the vaccines. They said it should be a shared decision between the provider and the patient, which is a problem since nobody knows it's a disease, and many of the providers, the internists, are not really aware of the trials, the limitations, the potential side effects. So I was ecstatic, and I'm struggling to find a way forward to really utilize these vaccines effectively.
Well, thanks for your honest answer, because it was about to be my next difficult question, no? Your view on the ACIP positioning, no? on the RSV vaccines, and you already went through it on your own. So thanks for that. So without that, which should be your ideal indication? I mean, if you had the power to decide, and with the knowledge you have, and you have a privileged view on the subject, with the knowledge we have about the disease and with the knowledge we have about the available vaccines, which would be your ideal recommendation?
Okay, so one of the reasons I think that they came to the shared decision-making is there were some neurological events in the trial. So Guillain-Barré and Adam. And so it's unclear if those are real but rare side effects or just random, because Guillain-Barré in particular, the incidence goes up as you age. Mm. And so it's not that far out of the realm of what we might expect. The only way to answer that question is for the vaccines to be widely used and very robust post-marketing surveillance. And therefore, I think you would want to recommend it in people in whom the risk, and you could calculate this, the risk of severe RSV and ending up in the hospitalization significantly outweighs the possible increase in the relative risk of these events. So I would say, again, sort of hearkening back to age is just a number, but certainly I would recommend it in people over the age of 75. The mm-hmm. risk of hospitalization really increases dramatically. And then I think we're pretty certain that people with very severe COPD and heart failure are at very high risk. And I would not have a problem sitting down and counseling that person that they should receive the vaccine. I wish that the recommending bodies would make a recommendation and not leave it to the people who don't understand how to make the recommendation. I have heard, and I'm not, I don't have, you know, that I don't know that this is true, but my understanding is that in the UK that they are recommending it for people over the age of 75. Mm-hmm. And probably it's available for other people based on need, but.
Yeah.
So anyway, so that's what I would do. Over 75, I would recommend it. Serious heart and lung disease, I would recommend it. And then I would work very hard to educate people how to properly counsel people as we continue to get more data.
Mm-hmm. Well, I tend to agree because, of course, I mean, it's not only agreed, you are the expert without any doubt in this matter. No, but also any high risk oriented immunization strategy tends to be a failure from the beginning, no? So to use any age limit, although it's just a number, as you said, but it's the easiest way to really get a good vaccine uptake, no? When you try to just pick the specific risk groups, sometimes it's difficult to really have a public health impact, no? In such a disease like, in this case, is RSV.
Yeah, I mean, I think you raise a really excellent point, and that was one of the discussion points on the ACIP meeting. That risk-based recommendations are terrible. But I would ask the question, because I'm not sure of the answer, is a clear-cut risk-based recommendation worse than a shared decision-making recommendation when nobody knows how to recommend it? I mean, yeah. I don't know. That comment comes from flu and from some of the pneumococcal recommendations, and providers get very confused, but I don't know. I don't know which one. Yeah. Neither one is ideal.
No, but it's very interesting, very interesting. I'd like to ask you a last very specific question. In fact, it's my own curiosity on the subject. No? You have been working on different candidates and all those licenses already. I mean, RSV vaccines are focusing on the F protein and its perfusional conformation, but you have been already working in other alternative antigens. No, I have read your papers on one vaccine candidate based on SH. Can you tell us a little bit more? What are your expectations in these alternative antigens against RSV?
Well, I think adding in some alternative antigens, possibly G, possibly SH, could augment the F-based vaccines. I doubt they're going to replace. I don't think they would be better. I mean, I think we know enough about at least the antibody response to RSV, that, you know, F is really the major target of neutralizing antibody, and the stabilization of pre-F that induces, you know, very, very robust antibody levels, I think is taught us a lot. It answered one of the questions, which I think we didn't know before the vaccine trials, is, well, is antibody alone protective? And I think that the challenge studies that they did, the companies, and these trials, which really this vaccine pretty much just induces antibody, show us that antibody alone can protect. You know, I think there's room for improvement, and I can't say about alternative antigens, but alternative approaches, you know, vectors and other ways to stimulate cellular immunity. Because, you know, one of the questions with these vaccines is how durable they're going to be, how, you know, do you need to give boosters? And so it's always going to make something more cost effective if you could really space it out to 5 or 10 years. And using a vectored approach or something that stimulates the cellular immunity that we hypothesize in the elderly is not up to snuff may be very helpful.
Well, I would keep talking with you for another half an hour, but I think that we have reached the length that we wanted to share with the audience. And I just want to thank you for joining us today. And also, well, I don't know if there is anything I have not asked you or any thought you'd like to share before we close this podcast.
Well, the only thing I would say is, you know, we focused on adults, but I'd say the landscape for babies is also quite exciting with maternal vaccination and the new long-lasting monoclonal antibodies. So I think on both ages of ends of spectrum, we're making progress.
Indeed. Thank you very much, Anne, and thank you to all our listeners. So on behalf of all the RSV Academy team, thanks for listening to us once more, and stay tuned for future podcasts to follow. We will have here Barney Graham, Octavio Ramilo, Alberto Papi, and Louis Vaughn, among others, as well as you should check with all the other activities from RSV Academy in the web page to keep you up to date in the interesting and rapidly evolving world of RSV. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.